Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with Jason Cannon. His title at Florida Studio Theater is Associate Artist, but that doesn't even begin to explain the varied and numerous jobs that Jason has, the numerous hats that Jason wears. Jason is the quintessential theater professional, which is to say he does everything. If you've seen Jason on stage, for example, in The Dancing Lesson, you know what a remarkable actor he is. If you have seen anything that he's directed, you know what a remarkable director he is. Well, I'm not going to tell you the rest of the things that he does because he's going to say it, and it's much more interesting to hear him say it than to hear me say it. But the truth is, listening to Jason and all of the things that he does and how hard he works, and that he manages still to have such a lovely sense of humor, to be so spontaneous and articulate, it's delightful. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Is about being the person you really are. Not the person you think you're supposed to be. Not the person other people are. Not the person other people told you you should be or even told you you were. Maybe not even the person you think you are, but the person you really are. Unfortunately, so many of us have had experiences in our childhood which tell us that something about us is not okay. And that something can bring everything from teasing and embarrassment to punishment and sometimes trauma. And when that happens, we learn to suppress that thing, to pretend that it isn't actually us. And our ability to pretend gets so good that we forget we ever were that. In my shows, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And it's my hope you'll be inspired to ask, is there something about me for which I am in denial? And my interview today with Jason Cannon is a wonderful, wonderful example for several reasons. When you listen to Jason talk about his work, when you hear him talk about being an actor, being a director, talk about what he does at Florida Studio Theater, you are in no doubt that Jason Cannon is the man he really is. And yet, he didn't find it right at the beginning of his life, which so many people who wind up as an artist do. No, Jason had to wait till high school. It's an interesting story, and it makes the point that it may not be too late. It was not too late for Jason to become the person he so clearly is, and it's not too late for you. But more about that later. Here now is the delightful Jason Cannon. I am here with Jason Cannon, and I'm explaining to Jason that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Oh, fantastic.
And you are clearly doing that.
Quite fortunately so, yes.
Yes, okay. I'm making the assumption that the art to which you have given your life is acting? Theater?
Theater as a whole. I am a multi-hyphenate.
Are you? Yeah, well, give me the hyphen.
I'm a union actor. I'm a union director. I'm also in SAG-AFTRA. I'm also a produced playwright. I am an educator. I've taught everything from grade school and camps up through university-level classes. I am the mentor for the Acting Apprentice Program here, so I seek out apprentices and interns and mentor them and teach them and set up workshops for them. And
oh, my goodness.
One of the reasons I was hired is because my skill set is quite disparate. I have stage management credits. I have design credits.
You don't look old enough for this.
Oh, that's very kind.
I mean, really, when did you have the time to...
Well, I learned early on as an actor, you can't control who the director casts, and you can't control what the producer produces. So I just kept kind of working my way up to becoming a director, and then a writer, and then a producer.
You just figured that you would do all these things.
The more hats you wear, the more often you get hired. I just really didn't have any patience or desire to do anything else but theater. Every job I have ever had since I graduated college has been theater in some way. Acting, directing, writing, teaching. I just refuse to do anything else.
Okay, good. So, this is my question.
Please.
Do you remember the very first moment in your life when this thing about theater, about acting, about performing, if you can remember when that was, can you tell me?
Yes, it was high school.
High school? Wait, that's kind of late.
It can be. We moved a lot when I was a kid. So it was just pretty much my brother and me and my parents. We just moved a lot for various reasons. And we moved again after my freshman year in high school. And I'm sitting there the week before classes start with my mother and my guidance counselor, Mr. Torrance. And I had an extra slot in my schedule. And Mr. Torrance and my mom said, hey, what about forensics? And I had no class. I was like, criminal science? They're like, no, public speaking. I'm like, sure, whatever, fine. Because I've seen my family in front of people my whole life. My mom's youngest sister got her MFA in acting. My grandfather was on a radio show for many, many years and then a preacher. I saw him preach and sing all the time. My uncle was a singer. My mom's a professional soprano. It's not weird to see our family performing.
No, clearly, but yeah. There was no hint of that for you earlier.
No, Wes and I, my brother, we were very introverted because we moved so much. We were only 2 years apart, so we were best friends. But we moved so often, we didn't really have other friends besides, and so I was very introverted in school. Another reason I put so much of my energy into my academics is because I didn't have a social life, really, growing up. Outside school and the church, I didn't have friends.
So they put you in forensics, and yeah. What happened?
This wonderful, wonderful woman and teacher, Mrs. Walker, who just kind of saw through my two-facedness, my insecurity of not knowing anyone, but also my kind of front of ego I would put out as the smartest kid in the class, because that was my identity. That's all I had.
Right.
She saw through and kind of plucked me out and said, all right, as part of this class, everyone in forensics class had to join the speech team. And so I started writing speeches and learning speeches and going to speech tournaments. And through the speech team, I met the theater kids. And by junior year, I was auditioning for my first show ever.
Wow.
It was Cyrano de Bergerac. I played Linier, the drunk poet, and soldier number 87 who dies at the wall or whatever. And I was pleased. I was just excited to be part of it. Suddenly, I had this social life. I had this built-in group of friends. Okay, it was fun. It was art. You walk into that stage for the first time and have that smell, the sawdust and the face paint and all the cliches. I was hooked. I was done. And then continued with both theater and speech through the rest of high school.
And what did you major in?
In English and theater, double major.
So already, by the time you were going to college, you had somehow made up your mind that...
Theater was very important. I still took classes like general physics and aced them just because it's weird. I worked the math part of my mind and it kind of lets the artistic part of my mind rest.
Fallow.
Exactly, fallow ground. And also there's a precision in math that you don't really get in art, which is kind of refreshing. That semicolon is off. That's why it doesn't work. Oh, I fixed it. There's no fixing it in an essay. You can't get an essay perfect.
No. Hold on. Well, this is what I hear.
Please.
I hear you're in college and you're having the time of your life. You're majoring in these things that you love. You're getting the science fix. But have you thought what I'm going to do for my career, for my life, or you haven't thought about that?
No, it's just in college I was just experiencing it, doing shows, taking Shakespeare, writing paper. I think senior year I was like, do I go to grad school to write or go to grad school to do theater? It was one or the other. What ultimately happened is that the solitary life of the writer would not have been healthy for me. I mean, I need my alone time, but the social aspect of theater was like breathing. I don't know that I could have said that then. Looking back, I think that's why I started to drift a certain way.
Apparently you are going to graduate school. It's just a question of in what?
Yeah. I was scared. Every year I would get all the packets. I would look at UCSD and UW and UT Austin and NYU and Columbia, and I was looking both at creative writing and at theater. But then I just kept auditioning in St. Louis and I just kept getting cast. I was very fortunate. You know, you go to grad school to get better so you can get work, but I kept getting work.
Yeah,
so
right.
I just kept putting grad school off because I just kept... Now, I was living barely above the poverty line,
right.
You know.
But you were working.
But I was, at one point, I was working on 12 scripts at one time once. Everything I was doing was theater.
Yes.
I was living in a tiny apartment.
And you were using all of yourself, weren't you?
Yes, I just didn't know it.
But it must have been very thrilling.
Yeah, I felt, yes, it was. It was in a lifetime.
So it was pretty remarkable, actually.
It's very rare that people make their living just through acting.
Especially when they've had no training
yes.
and they're just out of school.
Yes.
Yes.
My plan was not to be in St. Louis long term, but you marry a St. Louis girl. St. Louis is very homey.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of became from St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate to land there as there was kind of a theater renaissance happening in St. Louis. It's a much better theater town than people realize. I just kept working. I was offered my equity card, turned it down the first time because I wasn't ready. The second time I was offered, I took it, and I was super fortunate. By that point, I worked my way up, and I was getting work that paid me that I could live on.
Right, right. Still St. Louis.
Still St. Louis, yeah. I spent about 13 years there. And I was very fortunate. The last 5 years I was there, I was acting in 3 shows and directing 3 shows a year. A turning point for me, Lynn, was I was at Stages St. Louis. I was playing a small role in understudying in State Fair. And all of my scenes were with this... young man out of New York who had been in Miss Saigon as a swing for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember looking at him going, you are really good, but you are coming to St. Louis in the summers to get your artistic fulfillment, to play the lead roles. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, it's awesome. You're on Broadway, but you've been a swing for 5 years. And that is, what I realized was that success is completely subjective. And I tell my apprentices here that all the time. There's no one right path. There's no one right school. There's no one right way. And success is whatever you decide it is. And for me, doing multiple shows a year was far more fulfilling. I had moments of like, what if I moved to Chicago or New York, and would I make it, and could I compete? And what became very clear as I worked at bigger and bigger theaters in St. Louis was that, yeah, absolutely I could, but I was very comfortable there. Again, I was married, had a life, I was teaching a lot.
Yeah, you had what you wanted.
Yeah, I mean, I was just like, very much so.
Who can say that?
Yeah, very much so. I would, you know, often play a supporting role like at the Rep or Shakespeare Festival St. Louis, make my awesome big living wage, then go play a lead role for a smaller company that was entirely fulfilling, paid less.
Right.
I love acting without, you know, sounding awful. I'm very good at it. I've committed a huge chunk of my life to it, but want to direct. So I got my MFA in directing there in St. Louis.
So then what?
I kind of hit 2 ceilings. Got divorced. The other ceiling I hit was that kind of professionally, I'd hit that place where I could keep doing the same stuff over and over, work at the same level over and over, but I wasn't breaking into the national company. Like the Repertory Theater, they were hiring me to run their Wise Right program and to direct their children's touring show, but they weren't hiring me to direct a main stage show. Shakespeare Festival St. Louis, I was being hired to play Banquo and Master Page, but not Master Ford or Hamlet. You know, it's the classic reason why a lot of actors keep a New York P.O. box or a New York area code, so that agents and producers think they live in New York.
Yeah, right.
There's this false idea that an actor from out of town is inherently better than the one in your backyard. It's just not true. That attitude prevails everywhere. So I kind of hit that where I knew everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I was producing. I was directing. I was actually running a summer stock company. So I was a producing artistic director. I was still a freelance actor, freelance director. I was still teaching adjunct. I still had a very nice kind of setup going on. And also just the freelance lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
It's a grind, man.
It's
a double-edged sword. You've got your freedom, but you don't have your stability. I hadn't had a day off in who knows how many years. You don't have a day off when you're freelance. Not really. And so because of those two things, and because my parents had moved, my brother had moved, you know, I was just kind of there by myself. So I just started looking, you know. I stayed nearby because I was running the summer stock, and which is a lovely little theater. I just started, you know, just cast the resumes wide. And I interviewed near Pittsburgh at a school, and I was offered a job in South Carolina. And then two of my colleagues in St. Louis forwarded me the posting for this job, associate artist at FST. And I was like, Florida, cool.
Exactly.
And I was sending resumes, so I just started off, and then it happened really fast. I interviewed James, and then they set me up with Richard on the phone, and then they flew me down, and I got off the plane, and I was like, I hope they offer me this job. I interviewed with everybody, and it just seemed like a really good fit all around.
So tell me about Constellations.
A playwright was inspired by this idea of the multiverse. So a scene will be going on, then you'll hear a ding or a buzz, and they'll go back and start the scene again. It's not that they're repeating and trying to get it right. It's not a redo. It is literally jumping from different universe to different universe. So there is a scene which is basically made up, say, of five universes of girl and boy meet. And it's five different versions of that. And in only one of those versions do they actually click and decide to go on a date. Jump ahead to the next scene, and we're in a world, we're in a scene where it's first dates, but we see like seven different first dates, and not all of them go well, right? But it's the same two characters, it's the same two people, and what you see is how the slightest change in a tone of voice, the slightest nuance of a single word, can have unimaginable consequences to how the rest of that plays out. We think, we love to think we have free will. We love to think that we are fully actualized, complete agency human beings. But if you look back and think about, how did I end up in Florida? Right? How did I end up here? You look back and it's the classic, you know, ennui, you know, tragedy is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes a tragedy. Tragedy is not that it's an accident, it's that it's inevitable.
No,
it's
that you see it, you could see it coming if you look back.
Right. As soon as you look back, you go, without this domino, this domino, this domino. It's the Titanic, right?
That's
a
right.
Night to remember. If that person on the Carpathia hadn't put the SOS underneath a pile of something else, who knows? And so it becomes, that's what becomes almost Greek about it. You know, tragedy is inevitable. It can only happen one way, and that's the way it happened.
Mm-hmm.
This play says, well,
maybe not.
What does inevitable mean?
Right.
Let's explore this idea of inevitable. Let's explore this idea of free will. And the character of Roland even pushes back against the scientific Marianne about, if everything I've done has already happened, why does it matter what I do? And it's the classic predestination versus free will argument. Much more nuanced here, but isn't that something humans have been dealing with since they were able to realize they were human?
Since they had awareness.
Right, and it all goes back to why are we here? I mean, that's, of course, the ultimate question. Why
and that
here?
Lovely speech about the bees.
Yes.
And wouldn't it be lovely if we knew?
Yes, but bees don't know.
No.
They may have a clarity of purpose. And
yes.
For those of you who haven't seen the play, when Roland proposes to, and I'm not giving anything away, when he proposes to Marianne, he's a beekeeper, and he's written this amazing speech about how there's three types of bees. They all have very specific jobs. There's a clarity of purpose. Their lives are short. If only we could know why we are here, too. I don't know much, but I do know I want to marry you.
Yeah, right.
Right? It's a beautiful speech, and you get to hear it multiple times.
Yes, you
and it
do.
Sounds a little bit different every time.
Yes, you do.
But that's just that bees don't know that that is their purpose. They just are.
That's right.
There is a glory to lacking self-awareness. There is a comfort in the life of being a dog where you're always simply in the moment.
On the other hand, you're at the mercy.
Absolutely. And that's where the tension comes in then, is that in these two characters too, Marianne wants that clarity, and Roland is much more open to just being present. And how do people like that fall in love, stay in love, hurt each other, wound each other, heal, come back together? What's great is that both characters as well, and this is something I, this is a preference I have, this is something I've struggled with for years in terms of playwrights and playwriting, is that I love seeing stories of normal people. Right? These are just average people.
Mm-hmm.
Living their quote-unquote average lives. But there's no such thing as a normal life. And that's what's wonderful, too, is we're not necessarily showing kings and queens and magicians and, you know, the high and mighty and the richest of the rich. We're showing people who just are struggling to find meaning in their life.
That's, I think, exactly the point, isn't it? To find meaning in their life.
Yeah.
It's quite compelling.
It rings the actors out. I mean, they have to go to every emotional corner of their souls.
That's
in
right.
70 minutes and sometimes turn on a dime from
yes.
highest tragedy to lowest comedy.
Right.
Immediamente, right?
Yeah, yeah.
There's no place for them to...
Rest.
And also, it's just... And this goes to our stage three aesthetic as well, which is we're doing it here in the lab, very intentionally, really stripped down. It's Peter Brook's empty space, right? It's just actors in a space with an audience. They each have one costume, there's two props, and there's no set.
No, there's nothing.
Zero set. There's some sound design, and there's a cool star drop for lights, and that's it. And it's just that we actually started, when we started staging, we actually had two chairs, and then we realized within about 10 minutes that these chairs were... We didn't want them and we didn't need them, right? And we were so angry at the chairs for getting in our way. Because then suddenly we're thinking, but as soon as the actor has to move a chair, he's not Roland anymore, right? And so to maintain the integrity of these people are just colliding in different universes, that we stripped it down. We talked about having coats. Those went away. We talked about, you know, just it's simple a production as you can imagine, which lets you focus on just how intricately it is written and how beautifully these actors just navigate every emotional slalom you can
imagine. I was just going to say that the pressure is all on the actors.
Absolutely.
They got nothing but themselves
there. And it's Florida Studio Theater. That's who we are, right? In this space, it's 100 people, and even in the balcony, you're no more than 20 feet away from the actors, and they're in your lap.
Right.
And it's about, it truly is about, again, that Greek idea. It's the real-time flesh and blood relationship between three-dimensional actor and three-dimensional audience member. Theater only exists when there is an audience, right? Without a watcher, there is no watched.
Come and watch.
Yes, I think you will have a lovely time. And hopefully you will leave as wrung out as the actors were after every time they ran it.
I have one more question,
sure.
And it is, having given a life since high school to this work, is there anything that you would say about what it's like?
It's about the audience. It is about giving away as much as possible. For me, yes, I explore, I find truth. I'm not religious anymore, but I find as much sacredness and holiness in the theater as I ever did in church. I played Hamlet once, and to repeat those words that have been spoken by tens of thousands of people for the last five centuries, to share in that, to realize that it's not about me, that doing theater, the last person I'm concerned with is myself. The smaller I am, the more I feel like I'm actually serving the story, serving the audience. We are a creature, as humans, that crave narrative. We find truth in story, and to even just be a small part of that. And then here, too, to work with the kids to see if, when we do under six, and to see a third grader write a perfect two-page play, there is just nothing sweeter in the world than to watch that child and his parents watch them watch his play being performed by professional actors, to watch their reaction, to watch a father look at his son transform in real time as he watches this play that his kid wrote.
So it's a lot about service for you.
It has to be. It has to be. Otherwise you're an artiste or an auteur or a diva, and I have no patience for that. If I'm not serving something greater than myself, what is the point? If it's not bigger than me, then what's the point? I feel like there's a better way to say that, but that's all I've got.
I don't think that there's a better way to say that.
Oh.
And I think it's a great place to stop. Well, all right. This was great. Thank you so much, Jason Gannon.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Really, really, truly.
So, as I said, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And of course, as you can hear, when you listen to Jason, you are in no doubt but that he is being the man he was meant to be. He is using everything that there is in him to use, and everything that he uses brings him joy and satisfaction and happiness. And he's figured out why he's doing what he's doing. He's doing it because he is dedicated to service, to the greater good, to not only enjoying the thing that he can do, which obviously he does, but being grateful that others not only enjoy it, but really benefit from it. Lives are changed by what he does, by what he can bring, because it is what he has to bring. You can't really ask for better than this. I love what I do, and what I do also enriches the lives of the people who experience it. So, as always, I hope that as you were listening to Jason, you were asking yourself, is this how I feel about my life? Am I also doing what I was meant to do? That I am filled with the joy of what I do every day? Or are you doing things you would rather not be doing, that you hate doing? I mean, sometimes we have to do things we don't want to do, you know, but do you know what you would be doing if you could? Well, if you were unlucky enough to have been cheated out of something that is important to you, some way of being in the world that you would have been if you hadn't been discouraged, it is not too late to recover. I need to say that just because I have said it's not too late, and you know what it is you want to recover, it's not as simple as, oh, okay, now I'll stand up for myself when people are unkind to me. Or I'll say no when I really mean to say no and not yes when I actually wanted to say no. Or I will sew. I have always wanted to sew and I've never really given myself the opportunity to enjoy that activity or whatever it is. So if you want to talk about that, you can find me at my website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynshow, thelynshow.com. Click on the email tab, ask me any question, and I will respond. So, as always, I hope you got something you could use from this show. Something that you simply enjoyed, something that you learned, maybe something that inspired you, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boy. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. Chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't all. Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not. don't sing. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten